1971, a classic from The Temptations, Just My Imagination. Sort of what the military wishes the public would believe about UFOs. It's just our imagination. Or it's all a planet, it's a plane, it's a meteor, it's a balloon, it's swamp gas. It's imaginary, illusory, unimportant. Move along, folks, nothing to see here. That's what we've been hearing for so long. There are no secrets, there's nothing to disclose. Those who don't want the UFO subject to be taken seriously, let alone to have some sort of official confirmation, tell us the government has already revealed all that it knows about flying saucers. Or they say government files prove that there's nothing to it. They have already proven the saucers are some sort of a modern myth. The military wouldn't lie to us, would they? The fact is the government is well aware that is not the case, that flying saucers are a matter, or at least were for a while, a matter of national security or of national concern. What we've had is a pattern of lies, misinformation, disinformation, obfuscation, and it's all laid out. This is not supposition on my part. It's all laid out in the government's own words in documents that were never supposed to be seen by the public, that were written prior to the Freedom of Information becoming the law of the land. One of the pioneers who squeezed this paper trail out of the government, they were reluctant to give it up, too, let me tell you. Squeezed it out of them is my next guest, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, a PhD who's worked for years for the Navy. He's one of the world's best known and most respected video analysts, taking apart UFO videos and photos. And his new book, The FBI CIA UFO Connection, reveals a whole bunch of secrets that the government really wishes were still secret. When we come back, our conversation with Dr. Bruce Maccabee gets underway. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Bruce Maccabee earned his physics degree from American University and has worked for the U.S. Department of the Navy as a physics researcher at what is now known as the Naval Surface Warfare Center. But over the years, he's become, even as he worked for the Navy, he's become one of the most respected UFO researchers in the world. I think he became one of my heroes, UFO heroes, because he was such a trailblazer and pioneer for freedom of information, using the FOIA to squeeze secrets out of the government. He's also sort of not prone to exaggeration. He's acerbic, witty, and does not mince words and does not suffer fools, and I think you're going to enjoy talking to him. Dr. Maccabee, great to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here. Well, I'll try not to suffer any fools.
I hope I'm included in that. Well, the new book is terrific, and it's a compilation of work that you've been doing for a long time. I'd like to start, though, with, and we'll jump into specifics, but I'd like to start with how you've been able to be employed by the Navy and do this on the side. One would think that your employer would say, knock it off.
Well, I explained that in the book, and basically the employer said, we don't care what you do on your own time, just leave us out of it.
What does that say about the larger picture that a lot of people have about the UFO cover-up, that somebody in your position, I think the assumption would be, you're not allowed to talk about it or give it any credence?
Well, I would say the people that I talked to and the people who I worked for were so far away from the Center of Ufology in the government, wherever that is, that they didn't really know, and they're just as puzzled by the whole subject as everybody else. So it was not part of what they do on a daily basis. They just want to make sure that they weren't tarred with the same brush, I guess you might say.
Do you ever, does it come up at the water cooler and the employee lounge or at the Christmas party or something? Hey, what's the real deal on this, Bruce? Do they ask you?
Yeah, okay. Employees, some of them would tell me their own experiences, and they'd often ask me, what's the situation, or what I was working on at the time. And there were also severe skeptics as well, who tried to make it look like I was an idiot. But fortunately, most of the people realized I wasn't an idiot.
I made the statement at the beginning of the program that I, at least for me as a journalist, the paper trail, the documents, the stuff that you have squeezed out of the government, you and a couple of other folks, I consider it to be the most important evidence, the best evidence, because, you know, so much of The other kinds of evidence dealing with UFOs is pretty hard to pin down, but this is sort of the government's own words, and they never expected this stuff to be made public. Can you give us at the beginning here sort of a general statement about the quality of this evidence and what it means?
Well, as a reader of the book will find out, I've sort of used the FBI as a guide to writing a history of what happened in the early days of the UFO subject, which began in June of 1947. The FBI was asked to investigate witnesses, asked by the Air Force to investigate witnesses within a couple of weeks of the first sighting. The information that the FBI got went into an FBI file, supposedly never to be seen by anyone. It wasn't until 1977 when I got the first documents out of the FBI that anybody had seen what was in there. The FBI agent who handled my Freedom of Information Act request was just as surprised as everybody else, and he admitted it. He didn't think when he had been put on the job of answering my request, he didn't think he was going to find anything. And instead he found over 1,000 pages of stuff related to UFOs.
Well, you say in the book, in the early part of the book, that you were working on something, the Trent UFOs, the McMinnville case, which anybody who studied the phenomena knows those photos because they're really very famous, and you're analyzing those things, and that's sort of how you got the idea about asking the FBI. Tell us that part of the story.
Well, yeah, that was how, like I said at the very beginning of the book, this book wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for the fact that Paul Trent took a couple of pictures of UFOs, and those pictures were essentially endorsed by the scientist William Hartman, who worked for the Condon study in 1968 and 69, 67 and 68. I decided to see if I could duplicate what Hartman had done and either prove the photos to be real or fake. And so I got into an in-depth investigation of that Trent case, which took place in near McMinnville, Oregon, in May of 1950 when they took their pictures.
Is
So
that? I'm sorry.
I learned from evidence collection, other people's interviewing the Trents and myself interviewing Mrs. Trent many times, that Paul Trent had said that the FBI had come to visit him where he worked. And so I thought, well, I'll take a chance that the FBI might tell me whether or not they ever had any file on Trent. And so in the fall of 1976, I wrote a Freedom of Information Act request. This is only about a year after it became in force. I wrote and asked if they had any file on Paul Trent of McMinnville, Oregon. And sort of like as a side thought, oh, by the way, if you have anything else on UFOs, please let me know. I didn't really expect to get anything because we had very little information on whatever the FBI might have done. And in the book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, which had been written in 1955, he says in that book that the FBI was never involved. So I didn't expect to get anything. But 8 or so months later, I got a phone call from a very surprised FBI agent who told me that there was 1,600 pages of stuff in the FBI file. And that's sort of how it began.
Wow. I mean, did you think as soon as the FOIA becomes the law of the land, were you already thinking about UFOs and using this as a tool to go after it, you and some of your colleagues?
Well, some of the others, I used it simply because I was trying to get some information out of the FBI.
Right.
Incidentally, the FBI guy who called up says, we're not supposed to tell you anything about individual cases, but off the record, we don't have anything on Trent.
I know that even when I started, which was a lot many years later after you had already been doing it, in the late 80s, if you write to the FBI and the CIA, they'd give you sort of a canned response. Look, we never really, even then they were saying we never really studied this stuff. We got a little bit of material, and then suddenly this stuff comes pouring out. It was pretty clear from just the volume, even not even looking at the content, that they had in fact taken it seriously. Characterize for me what it means that they looked at it over such a long period of time. I know it goes back and forth for the FBI in particular, but what it means is so many agencies spent so much time working on it, analyzing it, arguing about it back and forth. Does it, I mean, it does indicate that they took it very seriously and they considered, at least to some degree, it was a matter of national security, right?
Yes, there were various reasons for national security. Readers of the book will realize that there's a lot of confusion as to what the Air Force Project Sign, Grudge, and Blue Book people had a certain level of confusion as to what they could identify things as and what they couldn't. The book is sort of the FBI's window. The first part of the book is sort of the FBI's window on what the Air Force was doing, but I couldn't have written it without the release of a lot of Air Force files that were not part of the microfilm Blue Book record that was released in 1975. In 1975, the Air Force, on its own, released a microfilm that included the files of Project Sign, which went from 40, well, it was basically during 1948, then Project Grudge, which went from 48, 49 to 52, and then Project Blue Book that ended in 1969. This file was not a complete file of the record of the Air Force, however. They also had a file of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations on microfilm. But even that wasn't enough to be able to write a complete history. We had to know what the Air Force intelligence was doing. And fortunately, they began reviewing and releasing files in the mid-80s that provided what the Air Force was done. So then I was able to write a history which sort of follows what the Air Force is doing as seen by the FBI. And at one point, I say in the book, what is a poor FBI agent to think? One day they'd be told that that these are Soviet missiles flying around. Another time they'd be told they're not Soviet missiles, they're just nothing at all. We can explain most of the sightings, and we probably can explain all of them. We're not really interested. The Air Force would say, we're not really interested in the subject. Then a day or so later, the FBI would get a sighting form saying, please, if you have any people wanting to testify relative to UFOs, use this sighting form to provide us with information. This off and on again type of situation, where the Air Force would be interested and then it wouldn't be interested and then it would be interested and then it wouldn't be interested. This went on for several years.
You know, I think there's those of us who look at this for a long time, and those who follow it even casually, have an idea that they talk about the government cover-up as if the government is one singular entity moving monolithically, you know. What really jumps out at you as you read all these documents that you got is that how there are these rivalries, there's mistrust, there's pettiness in between the different agencies and entities, and it's Keystone Cop-ish at some points. Can you help me with that characterization?
One of the prime examples, of course, is where the FBI was asked to investigate, the Air Force asked Air Force Intelligence and the Pentagon asked the FBI to investigate witnesses to check on the possibility of communist subversion, that is to say, communist subversives, sympathizers, generating spurious reports of things flying around in the air to make the American people believe that the Air Force couldn't control what was flying around. So anyway, the FBI and under Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, decided to actually investigate witnesses, and they did so for a month. But while they were investigating witnesses, one of their agents was given by sort of like a turncoat Air Force guy, a document which indicated that the FBI had been brought in to handle all the cases of ash can covers and toilet seats, to use the actual verbiage. And when Hoover found that out, he decided that the FBI had been brought in to handle all the trash cases. And that wasn't what he wanted to do, so he got the FBI out of direct investigation. That's an example of this petty rivalry stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, there is no one voice for the government when it comes to UFOs now. Well, maybe there is now, but there certainly wasn't back then.
Well, it certainly was primarily The voice, you mean by public voice, was primarily the Air Force.
Characterize for me, before we jump into specific documents and specific cases, characterize for me your words, sort of whether or not we can make sweeping generalizations about what this paper trail means. I mean, the idea that there is hostility toward the topic, that there is, whether or not the government has been honest with the public, whether the cover-up is real, in a sense?
Well, I argue that the cover-up is real, and it started very, very early, and the evidence of it is the confusion over not being allowed to use extraterrestrial or ET or interplanetary as an explanation for sightings. Those who have studied the subject will recognize the term estimate of the situation, which was a document generated in the summer of 1948 after about a year of investigation by Air Force intelligence at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, what was called Wright Field. And these men had analyzed a couple hundred UFO sightings, and they decided that this was unexplainable. Some of them were unexplainable, and they certainly, the logical conclusion was that they weren't made out here. They were objects made somewhere else. That was a logical conclusion. They tried to, they wrote a document called the Estimate of the Situation, which was passed along the chain of command up to General Hoyt Vandenberg, who was the Chief of Staff of the Air Force at the time. And he rejected the document ostensibly for lack of proof. So the experts went to Vandenberg's office to argue their case and essentially came away with their tails between their legs. Sorry, wrong answer was Vandenberg's response to their analysis. Well, now here, these guys were the experts in reverse engineering and studying primarily Russian aircraft, but if anybody would have known what was technically flying around, it would have been these people. And Vandenberg rejected their conclusion. So in other words, the logical conclusion based on the available evidence was interplanetary. And Vandenberg said, sorry, that's the wrong answer. Go back and find out something else. So the analysts were forced into a limited number of possibilities. Misidentification of natural or man-made objects, Soviet missiles, American secret projects, delusions and hoaxes. And there are a number of cases, some of which are in the book, which just will not fit under any one of those categories. So I conclude that the effect of a cover-up, and this is, by the way, is independent of whether or not Roswell is an actual crash case. Even if it weren't, you could have the same situation, that the Air Force did not want to have a policy that UFOs were interplanetary, which policy would have happened had they admitted that the analysts were correct in their estimate.
So these guys are working on this for months at a time, looking at hundreds of cases. They're laboring under the assumption, the incorrect assumption, that the Air Force really does want an answer to it, that, hey, guys, get to the bottom of this. They come up with one, and they're slapped down. And it's a pivotal moment in the history of UFO studies, because from then on, anybody who worked for the government in one of these positions never considered that fairly again.
That's right. They bandied it about a little bit, but basically they were forced into this set explanations that I
Well,
made.
We're going to come back. When we come back, we'll get into some of the specific documents, because it's a heck of a paper trail, and once you read this stuff, it's hard to come to any other conclusion. Bruce McAbee is my guest. The FBI-CIA UFO connection is our topic. Stick with us. From 1982, that's Marshall Crenshaw, his hit Someday, Someway. He's had a pretty good career, but I think people were predicting back then he was going to be a megastar. Didn't quite work out that way, but still, that sounds pretty good. We're talking with a superstar of the UFO world, one of the most respected UFO researchers anywhere, Dr. Bruce McAbee. His new book, The FBI-CIA UFO Connection, is sort of lays it out. the kinds of lies and secrecy that have been foisted on us by a variety of government agencies over the years. We're going to jump into some specifics from the actual X-Files right after this on Coast to Coast. Dr. Bruce Maccabee, can you give me your assessment sort of the cover-up? You think that the paper trail, as outlined in your book, shows beyond question that there has been a cover-up. Talk to me about the cover-up then versus cover-up now. It seems like, you know, in these documents that you show, there's a lot of candid opinions and analyses that are shared back and forth, where these guys say, hey, this stuff is real. We didn't make it. It comes from somewhere else, you know, within limits of security classifications. But how's that different from now? Seems to me that these kind of things would never be put on paper.
Well, first of all, the Air Force never publicly gave even equal time, shall we say, to the interplanetary explanation. The Air Force always referred to sightings as misidentifications, hoaxes, and delusions. And if they couldn't come up with an explanation for a sighting, it was always argued that, well, if we had more information, we could explain it. So basically, they tried to claim that everything was explainable. A project called Project Grudge made that claim in the December of 1949, and had an appendix to the project report, which they explained every sighting that they couldn't explain in the, during the first section of this large report. And people who read these explanations could see that there was the explanations were just plain poor or completely faulty. It was as if the Air Force was trying to cover up cases that pointed directly towards extraterrestrial. And that's what the Air Force was trying to do. Get rid of the extraterrestrial explanation as much as possible. And as I said earlier, this is my conclusion on the cover-up starting in 1947 is really independent of whether or not Roswell was an actual crash. I think it was, but even if it wasn't, the people who were the experts arrived at a conclusion based on analyzing sighting reports. And they weren't allowed, essentially, they weren't allowed to use their interplanetary conclusion as the explanation for sightings. They were forced to be illogical and use other explanations. Now, the cover-up back then was something that just started, I think, probably in 47 or 48, at least by the time of the estimate of the situation when it was kicked back to the Air Materiel Command people. The cover-up nowadays would be, I presume, so deeply buried probably in a contractor or organization, not in the government per se, so deeply buried that hardly anybody could get a hold of, could find it. This I conclude also from my own direct experiences with CIA people that I interacted with for many years in the 1980s and 1990s.
We heard Ben Rich. I've mentioned this on the program before, but Ben Rich, the late Ben Rich, this massively intelligent engineer, head of the Skunk Works, his company, one of the founding entities out there at Area 51, built the U-2, the SR-71. He said before he died in a public meeting, he said, look, we've got things that would take E.T. home, would go to the stars, but it's buried so deeply in black projects it'll never see the light of day. That's pretty close to what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, probably even more specific than I would say. He sort of alluded to where these projects, top secret projects, would be. I of course couldn't estimate that from looking at documents that are 50 or 60 years old. I can only estimate from the documents that I wrote about, put into the book, and the analysis that I put into the book. This is not just reciting the history of what happened, but what you might call historical analysis. You're given a whole bunch of historical facts, and then you try to deduce from these facts what people were thinking and what they were doing and what they might have done that wasn't actually in the documents.
Oh, Bruce, I think it's the strongest part of the book is how you weave together several different threads, you know. All right, the FBI is saying this. At the same time, the Air Force was doing this, and it makes for a very compelling sort of a overall story, and it makes it a
Yes,
lot
and
stronger.
as evidence of the confusion settling in and the existence of the confusion at the present time, every few years somebody rediscovers the FBI document that talks about an FBI document from March of 1950, which talks about a crash flying saucer,
Right.
an FBI special agent being told by an investigator for the Air Forces, is what the document says. It doesn't say who it was. That there were three crash disks with bodies and all that sort of stuff. And this was just after the FBI had been told by the Air Force that we're not interested in the subject. So Hoover writes to one of his agents to go and talk to the Air Force and find out just what is the Air Force opinion on flying saucers. And this is in March of 1950. And the opinion on flying saucers, oh, let me just say that that document attracts interest every time it's found by somebody who isn't familiar with the field, with the UFO subject. They think they found something that proves that the government has crashed flying saucers.
Right.
What was really important about that document was what it made Hoover do. Here, Hoover had been told, and this was, by the way, in the time frame of the green fireballs, which were flying around, and Hoover was being told that they could be Soviet missiles. At the same time, the Air Force was publicly poo-pooing everything, saying that there was nothing to it. So Hoover has his agent go and find out what the Air Force really thinks about flying saucers. The agent goes to the people of the Air Materiel Command and is told, well, we can explain most of the cases, and with more information, we can explain all of them. And we turned off our project to investigate back in December of 1949, which was a lie. They hadn't turned off the project, but that's what they told the American people. So anyway, Hoover was told that there was nothing to it. Then several months later, he gets another sighting form from Air Force Intelligence saying, if you get any information about flying saucers or witnesses, please interview them and find out the following information. So what happened was the Air Force blew hot and cold as far as the FBI was concerned. Sometimes the Air Force would be interested in the subject, and sometimes the Air Force wouldn't be interested in the subject. And publicly, it was never interested in the subject.
Well, you can see how the FBI would get tired of that, this yo-yo effect from the Air Force or whatever. One day it's serious and one day it's not. One day they want help, one day they don't. They want to hand off their trash can cases and things of that sort. And the FBI, I can see Hoover saying, you know, my guy's got better things to do than that.
It's interesting that in the FBI file there are documents that you don't find anywhere else. And one of them is December 8th, 1950, a document saying that the Counterintelligence Corps in Richmond, Virginia, told the FBI agent there, the Counterintelligence Corps, this is an army intelligence organization worried about counterintelligence. The Counterintelligence Corps had been put on immediate high alert for any information related to flying saucers. Now, when I got that document, I wrote under the Freedom of Information Act to the Counterintelligence Corps Freedom of Information Office. And I said, look, here's the document. Find it. And they couldn't find it. They couldn't find any reason why the Counterintelligence Corps had been put on immediate high alert for anything with respect to flying saucers. And of course, you have to understand that this is flying saucers were something which the Air Force said didn't exist. So the Air Counterintelligence Corps was being put on immediate high alert for something that doesn't exist. Well, that caused me and some other people to go looking through government documents to find out if there was anything that happened around December 8th, 1950, that could explain this document. And sure enough, we found something that happened December 6th. In conventional, unquestioned history, the American government was put on alert, and at between 10 and 11 a.m. December 6, 1950, because a fleet of 40 unidentifieds was detected on radar approaching the east coast of the United States.
Yeah, in the direction of Washington, yeah.
Their initial interpretation of this was that this is a fleet of Soviet, or their worry was, could this be a fleet of Soviet bombers? We don't have all the data available, all the data that probably would be available if it were possible to find. And it was just a lucky find by Don Berliner that we got a hold of a document out of what was then recently released Freedom of Information Act documents from Air Force intelligence of one of the organizations, I forget which one. But anyway, point is that on December 6th, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, the radar in Maine, we presume, detected this not large number of things approaching. And 10 minutes after the initial detection, these things were right over the radar station about. They had traveled probably 100 to 200 miles in 10 minutes, which is much faster than any Soviet bombers could do. And as soon as they were detected and jets were set up to check on what was going on, and an alert situation was put into the government, which President Truman wrote about, and Dean Acheson. I have two references in Dean Acheson, his own biography, and another his autobiography, and another book, which is also a biography of Acheson.
And they're different versions, too. So I had to smile at that. They come up with these kind of brushing it off, and they can't even get the lie straight.
Well, it was atmospheric conditions, or it was geese, or it was... In the newspapers, they talk about a single C-47 transport plane causing an alert. The most flabbergasting aspect of this to me was, they said the track of these 40 targets faded away, and evidently it was a friendly flight. But you have to realize that from the first moment of the first detection of targets coming, when they were 100 miles or 200 miles away, Air Force would have started sending IFF, interrogate friend or foe type messages, trying to communicate with this flight of aircraft. There would have been had it been real airplanes, there would have been a flight plan filed somewhere saying we expect to be flying, towards the coast of the United States at a certain time, at a certain location, and everybody would have known about this flight, and there never would have been an alert. The reason there was an alert was because they didn't know what the heck the things were, and numerous attempts at communication were apparently failed, and the only reason that they went off alert was that these tracks faded out, to use the term, in the document. The tracks faded, and they didn't know what they were. So I make a connection between this event on December 6th, and 2 days later, the FBI was told that the Counterintelligence Corps had been put on immediate high alert for any information related to flying saucers. It's a pretty close coincidence there, just 2 days difference. Makes me wonder if maybe those 40 items were flying saucers.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important documents in the whole book, and there's a lot of really important ones. Here's a phalanx, a flying formation of 40 individually identified, 40 of them. They saw them on radar. They're flying toward the East Coast. You don't know what they are. They certainly are, we later get these explanations, oh, it's birds, or oh, it's temperature inversion, but they scramble jets, they see them on radar, and they did disappear from radar, but it was because they reached the edge of the radar itself, right? It's not because they, they had stealth capability or something.
Well, that was my guess, but we don't really know, because the available document leaves a lot to be desired. It provides enough information so that we can make some logical deductions as to what happened. But exactly how they faded from view, I pointed out that after a certain amount of time, they would have gone beyond the range of the radar anyway. But as I was for the first time reading this stuff, I'm saying to myself, how could they say that the flight must have been a friendly flight?
Yeah.
How the hell did they know what it was if the track faded and they didn't follow it? Why didn't somebody else? The way it was traveling southwestward from near Greenland, the track would have carried these things right over Washington D.C. If they had been solid objects that were normal aircraft, first of all, they would have been going more slowly. But the second is, they would have been picked up by radar sets farther south as they traveled to wherever they were going. But there's no indication that they were ever picked up again after 11:40 a.m. or whatever the time was when they faded from view.
Bruce, tell me this. What's your take on secrecy in those days, the need for a cover-up? Were they justified, you think, in, hey, let's keep this to ourselves for a while to figure out what it was? I mean, that makes sense on one level, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I gather that the Air Force did not want to admit that anything was extraterrestrial or interplanetary. Even to themselves, they brainwashed themselves against it ever after the estimate of the situation. And not being able to, you, as I pointed out before, not being able to use that as a explanation, the logical explanation forced the analysts to use other explanations that they didn't believe.
So it sounds like you don't believe that there was justification for a cover-up even in the beginning, or I don't want to mischaracterize you, but you think that the reasoning is pretty shaky.
Well, I think if the Air Force never released the really good, even the really good visual sightings, so the outside world didn't know what the Air Force would have based their conclusion on. Now, if Roswell was a real crash, and they learned something about it, learned something from that, that said, you better keep this quiet, or civilization is going to be shaken by its neck
to its core.
Whatever.
Huh?
They might have learned something that was detrimental to the situation, and they might have said, "We better keep this quiet." That's a possibility, and that's a possibility even if Roswell wasn't a real thing. If they had such good, radar, visual, and so on data, that the top brass admitted that these things were real, they essentially set a policy that you can't admit that they're extraterrestrial, interplanetary. If Vandenberg had allowed that estimate of the situation to go through, so that he would have effectively established a policy that interplanetary was an acceptable explanation for sightings. And even if they tried to keep it secret, it would leak out somehow. The more people you have that are involved in a subject, the more likely it is the information is going to get out. So, by kicking back the estimate of the situation and rejecting the interplanetary solution, Vandenberg essentially set a policy that interplanetary was not an acceptable explanation, as I have mentioned before, and that forced these guys into a lot of illogical explanations when they had to come up with one.
You speculate on that a little bit in the book about it's not just that Vandenberg didn't like that conclusion or was worried about if it got out it would cause panic. You speculate that maybe he already knew the answers. He wanted his own people to not go down that line for a variety of reasons.
Yes, especially if the Roswell case was true. That would have been handled in a separate chain of command. But
all right. I'll tell you what, we're going to jump into Roswell in a big way in our next segment. Dr. Bruce Maccabee, FBI, CIA, UFO Connection, much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Procol Harum into the break.